The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We have taken a progression. Good morning. I didn't say good morning. We have been on a journey, sort of exploring the different points of tefillah. And nobody should assume that we have arrived at the end of that journey. We've really actually arrived at the next stage, which is exactly where we wanted to be today. This tefillah, the Shemona Esrei, the 18 benediction prayer, which became 19, I keep saying that, this morning I'll get a chance to explain it, is really the core of tefillah, of Jewish prayer. And it's not just a recipe, which we alluded to. It's a very directed system. And what I hope that we'll be able to do this morning is to take a look at the beginning of the Shemona Esrei, the first three blessings specifically, and to get a deeper understanding of what's going on there. Now, just by way of introduction, okay, I'll tell you a quick story, because how can you have a class on a story, right? This is an incredible story. There was a rabbi in Brooklyn, and I'll save the names because I don't know if we should repeat them. A rabbi in Brooklyn who, you know, had been a rav of a particular community for, I don't know, 15, 20 years, whatever it might be. And one day, an elder gentleman in his congregation comes over to him and says, listen, I have a Torah scroll that I've helped, you know, sponsored, and it's nearing completion. And I'd like to dedicate the Torah scroll to the synagogue in memory of my loved ones that I lost in the Holocaust. So the rabbi was really surprised. Because, you know, if you're a rav in a shul for 20, 30 years, you know your congregants. Dedicating a Torah scroll, that's not a small thing. I'm not talking about dedicating a letter. I mean, to dedicate a whole Torah scroll from scratch is anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000. This is a huge amount of money. And this was a little old man who lived in Brooklyn. The rabbi had visited him during his celebrations and during his, you know, moments of sadness, had seen his home, knew him, part of the community. This guy just did not have $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 dedicated to Sefer Torah, right? A Torah scroll. So he got a little nervous. Where's this Torah scroll from? Is it a kosher Torah scroll? You know, what's the deal here? But he didn't want to make the person uncomfortable. He said, oh, that's so wonderful, so great. So the only thing is, you have to give me the name of the scribe. Because as a rule, you know, people don't realize this, just like you check whether the restaurant is kosher, you know, you got to check whether the Torah scroll is kosher. And that's a lot of work. You know, if you buy a mezuzah, people think the mezuzah is the thing that houses the mezuzah. That's not the mezuzah. The mezuzah is actually the cloth, or the main part of the mitzvah is the scroll that's inside the mezuzah. I've had students who got all excited because I offered to make a mezuzah party if they ever get a mezuzah. And it's a longer story. You go back to America, you're all excited, you get the party, they come out with this beautiful gold and silver piece, but there's nothing inside it because they forgot that part, right? So if you get a scroll, the scroll has to be kosher. And it's an art to know how to check a scroll. You know, and usually you go to scribe. And, you know, someone who isn't a sofer, someone like me, would take me an hour, half an hour, to go through a mezuzah scroll and make sure that it's really kosher. So could imagine what it would take to go through a whole Torah scroll. So you really got to know who the sofer is, who the scribe is. So the guy says, sure, no problem. So he told him the name of the sofer, the name of the scribe. Calls up the sofer. Fortunately, he knew who he was. So he knows that the Torah is a, you know. The guy says, yeah, you know, this is a Torah scroll. You have nothing to worry about. It's super kosher. He says, I've been working on this Torah scroll for almost 30 years. 30 years. He said, yeah, this fellow came to me 30 years ago. He wanted to dedicate a Torah scroll. He wanted to know how much it cost. He said to me, well, what if I pay you like $100, $200 every month, every week, whatever it is, and whenever I have a little money, I'll give you money, and you write however many lines you can, and one day we'll finish the Torah scroll. So the scribe figured, all right, you know, it's extra income. I mean, it's a mitzvah. It's a Torah scroll. So he had this separate Torah scroll that was just this ongoing Torah project. And all these, you know, years of, you know, $100 donations eventually paid off, and now there's a Torah scroll. And the guy said, as a matter of fact, it's one of the beautiful, most beautiful Torah scrolls I've ever written, because I was under no time pressure. I had like a whole week to write a paragraph. So it's a beautiful Torah scroll. And the truth is, if I had to sell this Torah scroll today, I'd probably sell it for double what I ended up charging him, because it's that incredible a Torah scroll. So the rabbi said, wow, 30 years he's been doing this every week. I said, well, what motivates it? I don't know. I know he's been doing it fine. So the rabbi chops this fellow, you know, grabs this fellow and says, look, I'd just love to know what caused you to do this. Why did you dedicate it? Uncharacteristically, this elder gentleman said, I don't want to talk about it. I want to talk about it. Now, I don't want to talk about it to most people means, okay, respect your privacy. To rabbis, I don't want to talk about it means, ooh, there's a story here, right? So, you know, he persists, and they arrange a day for the dedication. It's a big thing, and he's going to dedicate it in honor of his parents and his siblings and a whole host of relatives that were killed in the Holocaust. And he says to him, look, you have to tell me this story. It's a mitzvah. There's obviously a story here, and it's a mitzvah to tell this story. So finally, this fellow relents, and he tells him the following story, which has caused me no end of food for thought. He says, when he was 15 years old, he found himself in the Anushka Road Camp. The Anushka Road Camp was a place you could write volumes that would just be full of tears of the stories of this place. This was not one of the famous concentration camps. It wasn't a place where you got off the train and they sent you to die. They worked you to death. And the camp commandant was a vicious, brutal fellow, and the guards were known for their brutality. The Blujava Rebbe was also in this camp. Tens of thousands of Jews were murdered day by day in this camp. He says when he got there, they had been in the ghetto, they were rounded up. They were separated before Yanushka. He watched his father shot. He ended up in this camp all alone. Can you imagine, 15-year-old boy. Your stories like that, you think about your children. 15 is, how do you... He said he had nothing left. He had no family photographs, no heirlooms, no nothing. The only thing in his life that he had from his childhood, from his family, was the boots that he was wearing. His father had been a shoemaker, and he had handcrafted a beautiful pair of leather boots for his son. And as they went through the ghetto, he made sure his son always kept them on, because he said, this is one of the most valuable possessions you have, because this could save your life. So he gets to Yanushka. It's in Poland. It's a bitter winter. And it's true. The right pair of shoes can save your life. And if you don't have a pair of shoes in Poland in the winter, you'll die. First day, after enough beatings and yellings and roll calls, they finally kick them screaming into their barracks. And they finally have a few hours with which to lie down on, you can't call it a bed. There's a spot of wood. And he's lying down on his barracks. And he's lying on his bed, couldn't really call it a bed. And one of the camp guards, an SS guard, walks in just to have some fun. And he sees this boy lying there with his boots on. So he starts screaming at him, why are you wearing my boots? Give me my boots. The boy says, what are you talking about, your boots? And he beats him, because, you know, you don't answer a Jew, you just beat him. Give me my boots. It takes this boy a minute to understand that the SS guard wants his boots. And if he doesn't give him his boots, he's going to be killed. He has no choice, so he gives him his boots. And after a little more beating, out walks the SS guard. And this boy is left in Poland in the winter, first day, all alone, no shoes. He realizes very clearly that if he doesn't have a pair of shoes, he's going to die. A moment later, they call a roll call. And they go screaming and running out of the barracks. And he sees this SS guard. And he realizes he has nothing to lose. If he doesn't get a pair of shoes, he's going to die. Polish winter. So he walks over to the SS guard, and he says, excuse me, I need a pair of shoes. If I don't have a pair of shoes, how will I be able to work for the Reich? So the SS guard looks at him with a snarl on his face, lifts up his arm, and the boy can feel the beating of his life coming his way. And all of a sudden, almost mid-stride, he stops his hand, and this evil smile crosses his face. And he says, okay, I'll bring you a pair of shoes. And off he walks, wait right here. So the boy doesn't know what to do. He can't imagine that this guy's going to show up with a pair of shoes. He's thinking to himself, what did I do? I just set myself up for something. He stands there for about 20 minutes, bitter cold, no shoes, all the while realizing that without a pair of shoes, he's going to die. And a moment later, this SS guard shows up with a pair of shoes. Now, they're not shoes like you and I know shoes. They're barely clogs. You and I wouldn't be able to last an hour in these things. We'd have pain in our feet. But at least there's something to cover his feet. Gives him the pair of shoes and yells at him to get out of there. And the boy puts on the shoes, doesn't have any choice, and on goes the rest of the day. And finally that night, they get back to the barracks, and he still can't figure out. He's in shock that this SS guard bought him a pair of shoes. And he doesn't get it until he takes off his shoes at night. Because when he looks inside the shoes, he sees parchments of a Torah scroll. And he realizes that what this SS guard has given him is shoes made from a Torah scroll. How do you walk on a Torah scroll? Could you imagine? Could you imagine just asking one of us to take a Torah scroll out, put it on the ground and walk across it? Could you imagine that every day you're walking on Torah? And then every day this SS guard is going to see this boy walking around and take pleasure in the fact that another Jew is trampling the Torah. But on the other hand, if he doesn't wear these shoes, he'll die. He doesn't know what to do. He has no choice. So he puts on the shoes, and every step for him is painful. And he vows to himself that if he survives this ordeal, and one day he's free, he will one day dedicate some way to make up, to fix the terrible burden that he carries in his soul that he spent over 2 years walking on a Torah scroll. And so when he's liberated eventually, he decides to have a Torah scroll written as a tikkun, as a way to fix that which he felt he undid. And so the Torah scroll is dedicated. Now I've been thinking about this story ever since I heard this story. And I'll tell you the conclusion I came to, although, I don't know, this is something you process forever. You know, at first glance, the fact that that guard took away his boots was the most horrible thing that could happen to him. And the fact that the SS guard gave him a pair of clogs made of Torah scrolls made it even worse. But when you look back on it, those clogs with that Torah scroll and the absolute determination that one day he would survive to see a Torah written and to triumph over his enemies was probably what kept him going through those 2 years. So that those clogs in the end, as painful as they may have been for him, were actually a gift. Viktor Frankl, who was a survivor from the camps, wrote a book. He developed a whole theory of therapy. He was a psychotherapist on what he saw in the camps and his perception of what kept some people going and caused other people to give up. It's a magnificent book. It's this thin. It won a Pulitzer Prize. I highly, highly urge you to read it. It's called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. His position in this book is that ultimately what we're really looking for in life is meaning. That's what drives us. And if we can find meaning in our lives, then our lives become meaningful. Now that may sound like a simple sentence, but that is one of the secrets of life. And the fundamental difference between someone who does this in a vacuum and someone who does this as part of something much larger is where that meaning comes from. Is that meaning something I give to myself? Or is that meaning something that I discover is given to me? Does it just come from me, in which case one day it's here and maybe one day it's gone? Or do I develop a relationship, in this instance, with my Creator, so that it's not just a gift that I come up subjectively, but some form of an objective gift? How do I discover my purpose? How do I travel through life and connect to this purpose? This is the recipe to this question. Okay? Now, we're not going to have a chance to go through the entire rest of the Shemoneh Esrei. We started this program. Rabbi Aaron shared with you one of the blessings. We're going to, God willing, conclude at least the educational part of this program with the blessings at the beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei. And I hope that this will entice you to take time to explore the Shemoneh Esrei. And one last thought. If you look at the beginning of the Sidur, in fact, since you have a Sidur in front of you, you can look this up. It's on page... We're not going to study this, but it's really, really worth exploring. It's actually a little piece of Torah that we study almost immediately after saying the blessing of the Torah, of studying Torah, right? The idea being, now that we've made a blessing in the morning, la'asok b'divrei Torah, to study, to travail with Torah, so now you have to fulfill the mitzvah. You make a blessing on tefillin, you got to put on tefillin. You make a blessing on an apple, you got to eat an apple. You don't just sit in a room with no food and make a blessing on an apple. Right? You have to fulfill the mitzvah. So this is the Torah study that the rabbis chose to begin our day with. So this must be a very special piece of Torah study. Speaks about those things. Elu dvarim shadam ochel perotehem ba'olam hazeh. These are the things, very rare things, that we eat their fruit in this world. Ve'akeren kayemet lo l'olam haba. But the deposit, the true return on the investment is in the world to come. In other words, sometimes we do things and we hope one day in the next world we'll figure it out. And sometimes we do things and we get it all in this world. But sometimes it covers the gamut. And what are those things? Respect for your parents, kumilut chasadim, acts of loving kindness. These are the highest, the most important. Isn't it interesting? It doesn't say here the wearing of the right hat. It doesn't even say here, keeping kosher, which I think is such a critical, valuable, and beautiful mitzvah, but that's not where we start. It doesn't start with Shabbat, which I hope, now that we've spent the Shabbat together, is a question mark for everybody. No. It starts with our relationship with each other. The beginning of our journey in the Siddur is not about my relationship with God. It begins with my relationship with my fellow human being. All about my relationship with my fellow human being. To respect your parents, to do acts of loving kindness. Haskamat Beit HaMidrash Shacharit V'Arvit, to arise early to the Beit Midrash, to explore Torah study. Hachnasat Orchim, receiving guests in your home. Still no mention of whether the food on the table is kosher. Very interesting. Just to receive people into your life and into your home. Bikul Cholim, visiting the sick. Hachnasat Kala, the bride who may not have enough to make her own wedding, special mitzvah to help a bride in need. Livayat Hamet, to accompany the dead, the story we spoke about the other day. Ve'iyun Tfilah, and exploring Tfilah. Layen is to take a good look at. You go into a bookstore, and you want to look at a book. You want to buy a book. How do you buy a book? Very interesting, some of the things we've learned at Israelite, by talking to the people who produce books. It's fascinating. Do you know how American publishing houses sell books? It's fascinating. You know what's most important in order of priority? This is amazing. You would think that the most important thing to sell a book is the content, right? Like, duh, right? No, no, that's like a separate issue. The color of the book cover. You have to put an enormous amount of energy. What color is the book color? If you're writing a Vietnam book, because you want to appeal to the people who like the war stories, and the cover is pink, you're finished before you're done. Right? Color of the book cover. Photo on the book cover. Okay? The blurbs on the back of the book cover. Now, you walk into a bookstore, how do you decide to choose a book? Now, I have right? We absolutely judge books by their cover, right? So I have this weird theory. Okay? I figure if I'm going to choose to write a book, the best way to choose to read a book is to open up the book and start reading it. If I like the first page, there's a possibility, right? Look at the table of contents. This is the beginning of the book. And at the beginning of the book, and what do I do when I do that? I'm being me'ayen. I'm taking a closer look. I'm not reading the whole book. I'm just being me'ayen. I'm taking a closer look, right? So yun tefillah is to take a closer look, to explore prayer. And then just to finish off the learning, to have at shalom ben adam l'chaviro, and bringing peace between a person and his fellow human being. The Talmud Torah keneged kulam, and the study of Torah is equal or opposed or against all of them. Now we're not going to study this right now, but if you want to understand that, what that really means is that the recipe to understanding how to do all these is Torah. Don't think that there's love between man and his fellow human being, chesed, and then there's Torah. Torah is the vehicle for knowing how to do this. If you want to understand, if we succeed, if I succeed, if my children succeed, you know, somebody was pointing this out to me yesterday. We were sitting at the table, and I don't remember who it was. Somebody gave something to one of my children. I think it was Yair. Yair said, thank you. Right? So if you're a parent, and you look at it, it's like, ah, yes. You know, a little bit worked. How do you get to that? I don't think you get to that because you watch Dr. Phil. I think you get to that because you study Torah. Not that you can't get to that by watching Dr. Phil. Not that you can't get to that through different vehicles. But the long-lasting, the recipe that's proven itself over 3,000 years, that's Torah. I just want to point out to you, okay, look at the things that the rabbis want us to study at the beginning of our day. We don't start with the tractate of Shabbat. We start with this, to bring peace to your fellow human being, to help a bride in need, to visit the sick. This is a very important tefillah. This is one of the few tefillot that I insist that my children know by heart. I want them to know this by heart. This is the bottom line. Now, pardon? This paragraph. This is at the bottom of page 16 in the Art Scroll Sidur. 16:16. Elu dvarim. In a minute, you're going to be studying, and I'll walk around if anybody's looking for it. I'll be glad to show it to you. Now, why do I bring this up? Because one of the things is iyun tefillah, the study of tefillah. Which is very strange, because this is all about my relationship with my fellow human being. So how does iyun tefillah fit in there? Except that we mentioned that the study of tefillah is supposed to be a recipe for changing who I am. And part of changing who I am is how I develop a relationship with my fellow human being. If I don't become a better person by the study of tefillah, by my tefillah, my prayer experience, then I'm missing the boat. The purpose of prayer is not to make me more mystical. It's not to make me more spiritual. It's not to bring me higher, although those things happen. Tefillah is also about making me a better human being. Okay? With that in mind, what I want to do, we started this program with the Chavruta, We're going to finish this program with the Chevrutah. I want you to take a look at page 98. It's the beginning of the Shemoneh Esrei, okay? And what I want you to do, all right, from the beginning of this prayer, which is the Hashem Sfatai Tiftach, or My Lord, open my lips, okay? Through the first three blessings, really, which is really one blessing, and so we're going to get to that, okay? Through Hakel HaKadosh, the God is holy, the holy God. Look at the text, so that you get an idea of what the text is, read it through, and then go back through the text and see what bothers you. And then see what you can come up with. Don't look at the commentaries to see what bothers them. And don't look at the commentaries to see what they answer to your questions, because then Art Scroll is learning the Tefillah, but you're not. You're learning what Art Scroll learned. First learn what you learn. Okay? And we're going to take a few minutes, 15, 20 minutes, just to explore this. It's okay if all you do is struggle with the first line. And while we're doing this, have some fun. Okay? Explore the beginning of this Tefillah, and then we're going to come back together and see what you got. Okay? Alright. We're going to do a little exploring now. And in order to do this exploring, I want to hear what you came up with. Let's, just to be clear, okay? Let's start with questions. Don't give me yet theories, we're going to get back to that. Let's first start with all the questions, and I'm going to make a list, okay? And I want to encourage you, if you have pads, alright? Because people miss this. You know, we're so used to the mode of, I'm in a class, I have to listen to the teacher. We don't spend enough time listening to each other. You want to do a smart thing. Make a list like I am of all the questions. It is very rare that some question doesn't come up that I haven't thought of. So I'm sure that must be true for other people. And down the road, when you want to come back to this and start to study it, or maybe even share it, the list of questions is where you want to start. So that would be my advice to you. Okay? So, let's hear what you got. Andy. Let's, by the way, just to organize this, sorry. Okay? Let's look at the first blessing. Those of you who are on page 98, any other page numbers? Pardon? Yeah. Any other page numbers?
125.
You're either at 98 or 125, okay? 179, okay? Does everybody have the place? So, if you look at either the English or the Hebrew, in the Art Scroll, one of the things that it does, which is great, is on the left of the English, it actually puts in the word Baruch. Now, the reason it does that is because that's the beginning of a blessing. If you look down below, you'll see Hebrew letters, Atah, you. That's the beginning of the second blessing. Okay? Alright? So, Magen Avraham, Shield of Abraham, that's the end of the first blessing of the Shemoneh Esrei, of the 18 benedictions. Okay? The Michaye Meitim, Resuscitator of the Dead. Ooh. That's the beginning, that's the end of the second blessing. Okay? End of the second blessing. And then, skipping the page, the piece below the line, the Kedusha, the two lines of Atah again, Atah Kadosh, that you are holy, ending with the words Hakel HaKadosh, the Holy God, that's the third blessing. Okay? So let's first take a look at the first blessing. Tell me what questions you have on the first blessing. Yeah. Oh, that's a very good question. Good question. Why doesn't every blessing start with Baruch? Okay? By the way, just out of curiosity, does anybody know which other blessings start with the word Baruch in the Shemoneh Esrei? Baruch, not Barech, Baruch.
In the what?
In the 18 benediction prayer, in the Shemoneh Esrei, in the Amida. You know what, let me just interrupt here for a minute. The Shemoneh Esrei, the word Shemoneh Esrei means 18. Okay? Really there are 19 blessings, and we're going to get to that. But it's called the Shemoneh Esrei. That's because in the time of Ezra, when they came up to the Second Temple, 2,500 years ago, the men of the Great Assembly, which were 120 individuals who set about to re-educate the Jewish people, including a whole list of prophets, some of which I mentioned the other day, Daniel, Mordechai, Chagai Tzfanya, Malachi, Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, all these great men, they composed these 18 prayers. Later there was a need to add a 19th prayer, because of the fact that Jews were selling other Jews out to the Romans. Interesting that the Jewish response to this was prayer. And they composed another prayer called Lamal Shanim. We're not going to get to that, but that's why now it's 19 prayers. But because it had become known as the Shemoneh Esrei, the 18 prayers, and because there's a difference between those who composed the prayers in approximately 500 before the Common Era, and those in the time of the Talmud who composed the 19th prayer in 300 after the Common Era, when they weren't even in Israel anymore, so they continued to call it the Shemoneh Esrei. So I'm going to use the word Shemoneh Esrei, because I'm tired of adding 18 benedictions. I don't even know what a benediction is, right? Okay, the Shemoneh Esrei. Number one. Number two, another word for the Shmona Esrei is the Amidah. Now the word Amidah comes from the word La'amod, to stand. And we actually mentioned this last week, that we, in our highest form of meditation, actually stand. Because we believe that we have the audacity to believe that we can, on some level, in addition to our awe of God, develop a relationship where we almost stand before God. And that's why it's called the Amidah, the standing prayer. And in fact, the tradition is that when you offer up this prayer, you know, you stand. And there's a whole custom, which we're going to get to in a minute, that at the beginning of this prayer, you take three steps back and you take three steps forward. And it looks like some little, like, you know, Japanese ritual. And somebody came over to me yesterday because Yair was davening, I don't remember when it was, Meir, and he's like this, and he's like looking at the base, he goes, and he just has it down real fast, and someone's trying to figure out what that was. But that's a whole educational discussion. So that's what we're going to say, Shmoneh Esrei. So the first blessing of the Shmoneh Esrei, okay, is this Magen Avraham blessing. So now, that is the only one that starts with the word Baruch. Okay? That's the one that starts with the word Baruch, for whatever the reason, because that's the beginning. Okay? This has a blessing at the beginning, Baruch Atah Hashem, and it has a blessing at the end, Baruch Atah Hashem. Okay? And we're going to get very clearly to why that is, but notice that. Okay? Yes?
Down, because you're like...
Okay, so I'm going to define this question as the choreography. Okay? The whole choreography, how I stand, how I bow, you know, you walk into a synagogue for the first time and you start to notice these things. Especially if you're a beginner. That's a gift that you give to people like me who grew up with this. They're doing this, 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 right? They're doing this. Like, what goes when and why? And what's fascinating is that people who've grown up with this, they don't think about it. Like, Buy a lot of sacks. Hang on, I'm just saying Shema. Yeah, okay, right? You know, like, don't say Shema when you're driving unless you're fast, right? What is that? Right? What is this? You know, there's a deep message in every of these choreographed pieces. So that's an important question. Right? For example, when I finish the Shmoneh Esrei, when I conclude these 18 prayers, right? So I take three steps back. Rav Haigon, one of the great Torah scholars of, he lived around the 9th century, and he was one of the two leaders. How many times in Jewish history can you say that there were two leaders who were the uncontested leaders of the Jewish people? He was one of them. And he suggests that if you don't take three steps back at the end of Shmoneh Esrei, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah at all. You just wasted your time. That's what he says. Bitel zmano. That's an unbelievable line. And I think what he's trying to say there is, the idea of taking three steps back is, I've just been in the presence of God. I've decided to take a step closer to God in this experience. And that's why there's certain things you don't do when you're saying the Shmoneh Esrei that you might do otherwise. You don't interrupt someone, you don't speak, right? Even though God's there all the time, sometimes I try to access God on a different level. So if I've really been in the presence of God, then I'm taking three steps back. If I don't take three steps back, I didn't feel like I was in the presence of God. If I didn't feel like I was in the presence of God, what am I done? What's the point? No, that's what I'm talking about. Those three steps back, right? You take three steps back at the end. What's very interesting is I take three steps back, right? And I do this very strange thing, which you may also notice some of you from the end of Kaddish. Oseh shalom b'momav, right? He who makes peace in the heavens, hu yaseh shalom, let him make peace. Now there's a big debate here. Do you say hu yaseh shalom aleinu, who he makes peace on us, ve'al kol Yisrael, or do you say hu yaseh shalom, he makes peace, aleinu v'al kol Yisrael? Only the rabbis could get into a debate about such a minute thing, you know? And imagine that you've just studied this today, and you go like this, and like, ooh, what do I do? So you get backache, right? Which is not the point, right? What is going on there? Very deep idea. You know, there is first the fact that God makes peace in the heaven, that peace comes from God, doesn't come from me. That's a very deep idea. We're all talking about the disengagement and the Middle East peace process. You know, what's Sharon doing, and what about Abu Mazen, and what happened to Arafat, and they're doing this, and we're doing that, and people out of their homes, and we kind of forget. Just remember where peace comes from. Hashem's running the show. On the other hand, hu yaseh shalom aleinu, let him bring peace on us. It's not just enough that there's objective peace, the peace is always there. It's, I want to feel it, I want to see it, I want to experience it. And then the third piece, the al kol Yisrael, right, and all of Israel. Because it's fair to say that first I think about myself. In fact, there's something valuable about thinking about yourself first when you give tzedakah. People don't realize this. Tzedakah is not supposed to be given to the starving people of India before you give it to your own. If you live next door to your brother, and your brother's business went bankrupt, and he's destitute, and his children don't have food, and you're giving tzedakah to poor children in Bangladesh, or in Jerusalem, or in Muncie, there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with you if you're donating your money to poor children in the next town over, even if they're the son of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and your brother is destitute. We work in concentric circles. By the way, as an international world experiment, maybe more than an experiment, as the ideal, this works, because if everybody would take care of their brother, there wouldn't be any poor. So that's a very important piece. So why do I do this whole thing? Okay, so we'll get into that maybe, but the right is very different from the left. And the center is very different from either. And whenever you see right, left, and center, it tells you that there are two sides. Right? The right in general represents giving. Okay? The left in general represents receiving, and we're going to get into this in a minute. And the center is the balance of both. So what I'm trying to do when I do that is a deep idea. But if I'm not thinking about it, if it's just the who's a doozy, who's a wootsy, then I've missed the whole point. Okay? The twist, right? Okay, so what other questions? Okay, excellent question. This one I'm actually going to take 60 seconds on. The halakha here, Jewish tradition, is very clear. Okay, there isn't even a debate on this topic. If you do not know Hebrew, and you're praying in words that you don't understand, you're missing the boat. You should absolutely daven in English. However, as you're going to see in a few minutes, you are definitely missing a large part of the experience if you don't know Hebrew. So obviously, what you really want to do is learn Hebrew. Okay? And by the way, learning Hebrew is not as complicated as people think, for two reasons. First of all, because there are all sorts of systems today that have been created. I'll give you one great example, which is now going to go on tape. There's an organization, which is a wonderful organization. It's called the National Jewish Outreach Program, started by a fellow named Rabbi Effie Buchholz, who is a very fine person. And one of their goals is to do exactly that. And they created, with experts in the field, a five-lesson Aleph Beis course. Okay, the beginning of Hebrew is recognizing and knowing how the Aleph Beis works. You can go to a course 5 times, 5 hours, everybody can find 5 hours, and you can learn the Aleph Beis. Start to finish, backwards, forwards, how to read. And then when you look at a prayer, you'll be able to read Baruch instead of just trusting someone like me. And from there, the process for studying Hebrew, while not necessarily easy, is totally doable. It's one word at a time. I'll tell you another issue. Every language has what's called keywords. Now, the definition of keywords generally means that usually a certain number, an empirical number of words, occupy 70% or more of the language. Now, what's interesting is, for example, in English, it's almost 500 words. There are 500 words, for example, the word that, the word for, the word the. Those are major words. If you don't know what those words mean, you get stuck in every sentence. So that means there are 500 words that if you knew those 500 words, you would be able to cover 70% of any conversation. And after that, it's just working with a dictionary. Now, how long does it take you to learn 500 words? Well, if you do 2 a day, which is not a lot, so by the end of the year, you have 70% of a language. Right? Now, English is much more difficult to learn than Hebrew for a variety of reasons, and that's one of them. In Hebrew, there are about 250 words. So you've already saved half your time without even starting, anything like that. Okay? 250 words. And, you know, if you go to a language course or whatever it might be, you can find out what these 250 words are. They're not difficult. My guess is, in today's world, you could Google, you know, and find them. And then you just pick 5 words a day, and in 2 months, you've got 70% of it. It's actually 77% of the Hebrew language. So there are systems for doing this. That's a B. Pardon? Like I said, you can Google it. You can, I mean, there are people who are experts. Go on NJAP's site, and there are ways to find this. There's a rule in life. The Talmud says, Yagata v'lo matzata. If a guy says, you know, I really looked for something, I couldn't find it. Don't believe him. If a guy says, Lo yagati v'matzati, I didn't look for it, but I found it. Found exactly what I was looking for. Don't believe him either. Yagati v'matzati, I really looked for something, and I eventually found it. Believe him. If you really look for something, you will find it. Of course, whether what you find is healthy, it depends on, you know, whether you want to be looking for it. If you're in the middle of the desert, and you're a crack addict, you'll find crack. Okay? And if you're a Jew who's spiritually searching and you really want to find it, you will find it. Which leads me to the last point on this topic. It makes no sense. It says, Yagati v'matzati. The person says, I struggled for it and I found it. It shouldn't say matzati. I found it. What does it mean to find something? I'm walking along the street and somebody left a wallet. I'm like, this is amazing. I pick up the wallet, no ID. Right? That's what you really want. You don't say it. You want the mitzvah, but you really want no ID. Technically, halachically speaking, if you find a wallet with no ID in Times Square, which is defined as a public place, you are not obligated to try to return it. It's considered a tremendous mitzvah if you do, but being realistic, probably, unless you're willing to stand there for 100 days saying, I found a wallet, which I wouldn't advise for other reasons, you know, you're not going to find the owner. You're allowed to keep that. You don't have to give it to tzedakah. You're allowed to keep that money. Okay? That's your money. You didn't do anything to earn it. You just found it. So it should say not, I struggled for it and I found it. It should say I struggled for it and I earned it. So why does it say I found it? So Rav Dessler, Rav Eliyahu Dessler, who was the Shgiach in Panovich and before that in England, he has such a beautiful idea. He says, when you struggle for something and you finally get there and you think you found it, right? You really feel like you earned it. Just remember, even when you think you earned it, it's really something you found. When you find something, it's a gift. It's like God knows you're having a tough day and you need $500 to pay the rent and He gives you the wallet. It's a gift. Even when you struggle for something, at the end of the day, it's a gift. And when it comes to Jews and Torah, it's always true. If you look at the amount of knowledge that's out there in the world of Torah, you cannot imagine how you could possibly get there. You know, whenever a student of ours, I don't push every student to yeshiva. I don't believe yeshiva is the be-all end-all for every student. Sometimes it could actually be a disaster at the wrong time. But when a person is ready for yeshiva, yeshiva can be an unbelievable experience. And then, of course, yeshiva is a higher institute of Jewish learning. Then, of course, the question is, which yeshiva, etc. I always give students one piece of advice. And just in case anybody here ends up going to yeshiva, you'll remember this. If you go to yeshiva, you hit that wall. You learn, you're all tested this, right? A month, 2 months, 3 months. All of a sudden, it hits you one day. This is ridiculous. I'm studying Torah from people who have been studying this all their lives. And they know whole pages of Talmud and Aramaic. I don't even know Hebrew yet. How am I going to do this? So my advice to a person is, when you hit that wall, give it 3 more months, and then find someone who walks in the door and learn with them for an hour. Find someone who came. Now, it's only 6 months in yeshiva, because this usually happens after 2-3 months. 6 months in yeshiva, walking in 6 months in yeshiva. You sit with someone who just walks in the door, they're a beginner, and it blows your mind how much you now have to offer them. And you can't figure it out. I remember sitting in yeshiva after a year, and I grew up traditional, but after a year of learning in yeshiva after high school, and I had the same experience. How am I going to figure out? How am I going to memorize the Ramban, the Mohammed, the Rif, the Rosh, the Ran? I mean, these rabbis, they know so much. And then halfway through the year, somebody gave me that advice, and I started learning with a new guy, and it blew me away how much I'd learned. And when you really connect to that, you really understand you could not possibly have accomplished that. You could not possibly have learned that much in that amount of time. And that's because that's a gift. If you will struggle and study Torah, Hashem gives you a little push. If I was telling you at the beginning of this, at the beginning of the week, somebody would be sitting here saying, okay, I was waiting for these guys to turn tutti-frutti, right? And it sounds tutti-frutti, I totally admit it. And I wouldn't say this to someone who just walked in the door. Of course, we're taping this, so somebody's going to think I'm tutti-frutti one day. But now that you've been here a week, maybe you get this. It is true with Hebrew. It makes no sense that an adult can learn a language so easily. I'll tell you why. It's because you're finding something that you once had. You're rediscovering something that you lost. This language is not a new language to you. This language is a language that your ancestors study. They've actually done tests to demonstrate that people have an easier time learning languages that they are part of, genetically and hereditarily, even if they've never learned. Not just Jews, but for some reason Jews have an easier time learning Hebrew. So that would be my advice. Go on the web, find NJOP, discover there are courses all over the country. Okay? There's a way to do this. Alright. Next question. Sorry. Pardon? National Jewish Outreach Program, NJOP. If you send me an email, I'll be glad to send you their information. Okay? Okay, yes. Believe it or not, that is actually a question for the third blessing. You'll see why. So hold the question. Okay. It's a very important question. Yes?
Okay, for the first brachos.
Yeah.
Why are we being so redundant?
Now hold those two 1 second. Let's look at this for a minute. This is really important. Bruch atah Hashem, blessed are you Hashem, right? Elokeinu, our God, Velokei Avoteinu. And the God of our fathers. Now let me ask you a question. I don't know about you. One of the greatest challenges in life is to develop a personal relationship with Hashem. That you can really feel that Hashem is my God. Not a God, but my God. Elokeinu. Now we say not my God, but our God. Because we're always about being in the community. That wouldn't be enough. It has to be the God of my forefathers. By the way, if I was already going to say this, I would think the order should be the opposite. God of my forefathers, now I want to make him my God. That's not what we say. It's my God and the God of my fathers, right? Why do I need that? What does that mean? Second, if I already said Elokei Avotenu, the God of my ancestors, why do I say Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov? Doesn't everybody know who the forefathers are? It's a confusing word, because there aren't really four fathers, there are three fathers, there are four mothers, but we don't call them four mothers, but we won't go there. Okay. So why do I say that? Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Another question. What do Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov have to do with my Shemoneh Esrei? You come into a synagogue and you want to develop a relationship with God. Can you imagine? You know, I mean, I understand. You're learning how to play baseball. You know, and you're at the plate. And the teacher says, come on, I really want you to connect with the ball. You say, okay, Babe Ruth, Joe DiMaggio. Is that what it is? Is it some inspiration? Why Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Why not the guy who's the big guy for prayer, because he talked to God directly? Moshe. Moshe isn't here. So what's that about? Right. And there's a whole descriptive list. God is great, Kela Gadol, Hagibor, God is strong, Nora, awesome, Elyon, elevated, Gomel Chasadim Tovim, who does kindness, Vekone Hakol. Somebody here asked a question, yes? Okay, so look in the English here. This is very, very valuable. Kone Hakol, the English here translates as creates everything. Now I want you to know, this is a very important lesson, okay? This is a translation. And we make the mistaken assumption that this, the English, is this, the Hebrew, it's just in English. It's not true. Because a translation really is a commentary. Whoever translated this, Rabbi so-and-so, staff of Art Scroll, and don't get me wrong, I mean, they did a wonderful job, but it's still a commentary, it's their opinion. That's the greatest disadvantage of studying something in English. You have to, by definition, be studying it through somebody else's eyes. Which, by the way, does not mean, please don't misunderstand this. Don't walk away from here depressed since I don't know Hebrew, what's the point? You would be amazed how much Torah you could study without ever learning Hebrew. Okay, we're just talking about if you want to get to a different level. But there sometimes are words that are translated that don't necessarily have to apply. I will give you a classic example. We prayed together, davened together, Kabbalat Shabbat. The receiving of Shabbat. And the first prayer of Kabbalat Shabbat, does anybody remember the first two words? Anybody? Lechu neranana. Now, what does Lechu neranana mean? Let's say that neranana means to sing. It actually is a form of joy. Joy is singing. Rina is a form of joy. Pure, unadulterated, beyond words joy. So what does Lechu neranana mean, if neranana means sing in joy? Lechu. Let's all go. But if you look in the Art Scroll Siddur, it does not say go and sing. It says, come, let us sing. But that's not what the word means. Now, I think the reason that they translated it as come was because they had in mind the person coming to prayer at a new point. It's very uncomfortable to say go and sing. Go where? Go sing! Strange. And that's a very deep idea. Lechadodi. Do you ever think about the words of Lechadodi? Beautiful prayer. We're going to visit the exact spot where that prayer was written by Shlomo Alkabetz 500 years ago in Tzfat, if you're with us on Thursday, and it will blow your mind. You'll never say Lechadodi the same way again. But when you really think about those words, was that a good plug? Plug. Right? But whenever you sing the Lechadodi, it sounds so beautiful, right? Because you read the English, come my beloved, that's not what it means. It means go my beloved. You get home, you just got married, you had a week of Sheva Brachos, maybe you feel you want to go on a honeymoon. Maybe you realize the Sheva Brachos was a honeymoon. I don't know, whatever it is. You finally come into the house for the first time, and you stand in the living room, you know, or the kitchen, depending on how smart a husband you are, and you say to your beloved, go, my beloved! So she looks at you like you're an idiot. But that's what it means. And of course, there's a very deep idea there. Lecha dodi, which refers not just to my wife, it refers to our relationship with God as lovers. And God is telling us, lecha dodi, we're on a journey. We're trying to get somewhere. We're going somewhere. And the word lech means that this life is all about going, and if I ever think I got there, I'll never get there. And that's true here as well. The word kone is a very important word. So I'm not going to explain why they called it create. I understand, and you'll understand when we get to the word, but I want you to know that that's a mistranslation. It's not exactly what the word means. Of course, that's because we think the word create is the word kone. But create is just an idea that relates to the concept of kone. So maybe they're choosing a different word. Was that too confusing, or you got it? Okay. All right. So now let's take a look. Yes. Ooh. If you look at the first line, above the beginning of Shemoneh Esrei, which was added by the Talmud, Kain Masechet Brachot, right? Tractate Brachot. I have to preface this by saying, right, that these are six words. Now, there are different opinions on tefillah. So I'm going to share with you mine. You do not have to buy into this. But since this was written by such an august body of men, 2,500 years ago, okay, they were very, very particular about what they were doing. It's very clear when you start to get into this that there's a pattern here and that the words are very specific and they relate to other words. This is a deep thing. If you've got prophets writing something down, they're thinking about it. Okay? Numbers in Judaism are very significant. We mentioned this last week. Okay? The number six is very significant. Does anybody remember what we said the number six represents?
Incomplete.
So, six words that are my introduction to the Shemoneh Esrei. They're a line that I say only when I say this prayer, and this line I say whenever I say this prayer. In the afternoon, in the evening, right? The blessings of the Shema that we spoke about last week, those I only say in the morning, or in the evening. But this is specific to this prayer of Shemoneh Esrei. So there's six words. I think the reason that there are six words is because words are incomplete. My words fail me. I know that what I'm going to try to do, I'm not up to the task. I'm not really able to completely connect to my purpose in this world. I'm not really able to completely connect to you, but I want to try. Six represents the human endeavor. The human endeavor on a certain level is always incomplete, and that's great. Because if you ever think it's complete, you're missing the boat.